My social media is very powerful. I guess Mark Zuckerberg just recently said Trump is number one in the world. On social media, which is a very nice statement, I guess. Something you can be at least a little bit proud of. Fight the fake news.
New time this week for music credits. You can find the complete list of songs and sound bites at the program's Facebook page. What's the Frequency, Paul? Jim Freund will be along shortly with Hour of the Wolf. But first, I have to hawk you to become a listener supporter. And more specifically, my job is to get five of you to become BAI buddies. That is, get five of you to sign up to send BAI $10 a month for each of the next 12 months. Because if enough people send this small donation every month on a predictable basis, we can have a predictable base of support. Maybe even spend less time fundraising and more time making programs. So let me make a direct pitch to those of you who like What's the Frequency, Kenneth. You can become a BAI buddy in the name of my program. Just go to give to WBAI.org. That's give, the number 2, WBAI.org, and pledge $10 a month for each of the next 12 months. You can become a BAI buddy in the name of my program, or Hour of the Wolf, or any program, or just the station in general. But right now I'm asking for five people who like my program to become BAI buddies.
And then it came to nothing. The summer sugar.
To be blunt, if What's the Frequency, Kenneth raised enough money for the station, it wouldn't need to be preempted during the fund drives. And if not enough of you respond with donations this week, I guarantee I won't be on next week, because the station will have to replace me with a fund drive program that's better at raising money than I am. So if you like What's the Frequency, Kenneth, now's the time to help ensure it's on by helping ensure that WBAI is here to run it. Go to give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org, and become a BAI buddy in the name of What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Thanks, and maybe see you next week.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Well, I was told that we're running 6 minutes behind. It's only 3 minutes behind. So I didn't have my theme queued up. My apologies. But it does give me the opportunity to say, wasn't that show wonderful, the one you just heard with Paul Fisher? Isn't that something that you like? Isn't the show that we are about to do fabulous? Well, let's assume that you're listening to an archive. Yeah, it was great. Therefore, you need to become a WBAI buddy, or excuse me, a BAI buddy. It's more alliterative that way. You can choose to give your support to WTF, K. One has to be careful when one initializes Paul Fisher's show. It's WTF, but it stands for What's the Frequency. Or you can also donate to WBAI under the name Hour of the Wolf. One way or the other, donate. Become a BAI buddy. There are reasons that I am not just saying give money to WBAI. There are reasons why I'm not saying that we can use your cash. We're cash poor. We need your support. But suffice it to say that money that goes to WBAI buddies, which is sort of like a Patreon for WBAI, it means that you give a certain amount every month, goes directly to WBAI. It does not necessarily go to Pacifica, that lovely, kind organization that took us off the air for a month in October. BAI buddies, oh, we get to keep that money. You betcha'em. So to become a member of WBAI, be a BAI buddy. And the way you do that is by giving a telephone call to area code 516-620-3602. Or, here's the easiest way, go to WBAI.org. And see where it says give, you know, donate to WBAI. And then there'll be a drop-down box that says donate in the name of a particular program. That could be What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Or that could be Hour of the Wolf. The choice is yours. The question of should you become a BAI buddy, well, is merely a question of conscience. And always let your conscience be your guide. So, having said that, if I can figure it out, and I think I can, let's start the show. Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program, well, often weekly, dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning is journalist and science fiction, fantasy, dark fantasy, and horror writer, Mimi Mondel. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. I'm going to state something that's probably obvious to you, but just bear with me. I need to establish just this point. The point being that the power of any story being told comes with us empathizing with the protagonist. That can be done in any number of ways, and with varying degrees of intimacy. It becomes an interesting challenge, though, when your protagonist has suffered a loss of memory. On the one hand, you can simply have your main character proclaim, "Hey, buddy, I've lost my memory." And since we, the audience, are being dropped into the story anyway, we're discovering things along with the protagonist. If you want to put an interesting twist on it, you can tell the story the way Christopher Nolan did in Memento, where the character suffers from short-term memory loss. There, Nolan reversed the timeline, telling the story backwards. So we only comprehend the narrative in terms of the moment being presented, with no idea of whatever context might have been provided in the moments preceding it. In the new French thriller, You Go to My Head, which is presently playing in theaters in New York, a woman, Daphne, played by Delphine Bafour, has been in an horrific car accident and, delirious, wanders the desert of what turns out to be Morocco, until she is discovered by Jake, an architect, played by Svetozar Tvetkovich. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that name correctly. He tells her she's his wife, that her name is Kitty, and takes her back to his home, a highly designed, stark-white structure in the middle of nowhere. Within this stylized environment, all flat plains and elemental forms, whose key architectural element is an in-ground pool, with a staircase to nowhere rising out of the far end, the man attempts to build a new life for Daphne slash Kitty, until shreds of reality intrude, stirring doubt in the woman and fear for what he might lose in the man. Director Dimitri de Klerk, who also produced and co-wrote the film, does a few interesting things to symbolize Daphne's separation from the past and her disorientation as she's indoctrinated into Jake's constructed reality. We drop into the film post-car accident, and what little context we get to Daphne's life before it, and why she might have no great motivation to return to it, is only provided late in the tale. When Jake brings her, quote-unquote, home, we see her reaction to first beholding the building, but there's no reverse shot to reveal what she's looking at. And in fact, we never get a full view of Jake's home, understanding it only as Daphne does in wandering the grounds and getting our orientation through her perspective. It'd be an intriguing way of depicting a worldview restricted by only what knowledge one character grants another. But there's a caveat here. It turns out that this beautiful Stark homestead is a real place, Phobe House. Again, I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Located a few miles outside of Marrakesh, designed by architect Guillaume Eustache, and owned by producer-director Dimitri de Klerk. It's his house. At least for part of the year, his mother lives there as well. Which raises an interesting question. Was the restriction of our viewpoint a calculated attempt to portray Daphne's own perceptual restrictions, or just a matter of familiarity, of not realizing, hey, everybody else hasn't spent their days here. Maybe they need to see what the whole joint looks like. I'm going to give de Klerk the benefit of the doubt here, because the rest of You Go to My Head is too exquisitely structured and beautifully photographed for me to think that he stumbled upon this idea by accident. The film has echoes of the thrillers by Claude Chabrol, where focus tends to be more on character than the crime, but with a Kubrick-like precision in the visuals. And if you think I harp too much on Kubrick in my discussions, it'd help if another key feature of the setting wasn't three freestanding, stark white monoliths. That's just asking for trouble. You Go to My Head is sensuously beautiful and beguilingly understated, a twisted love story that seduces you to embrace its own off-kilter brand of happy ending. And let me remind you about my new series, Historama 3D, where we take the wildest and weirdest public domain material and, through the miracle of the space brain's 3D process, turn it into something wilder and weirder. Our latest episode features the camouflage happy instructional film Rural Surveillance, and coming soon will be that classic of Cold War fear-mongering Duck and Cover. You can watch through the YouTube VR app or elsewhere using red blue anaglyph glasses. Just go in and search for Hist-O-Rama Space 3D. Historama 3D, the past was wacky. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Thank you, Dan. I'm sorry I've been busy talking with my guest and didn't hear a bloody word you said. I really do apologize.
Isn't bloody one of the forbidden words? No.
No.
Oh, yeah. It's bloody. It's not the UK.
It's not the UK. It bloody well isn't the UK. What are some of the other UK?
Oh, I saw that. I saw this on Twitter, like today, where somebody asked, like, is this a viral tweet? Where somebody asked, do people in the UK say bollocks all that much? And well, I spent some time in the UK. They do say bollocks all that much. And that was the answer to that.
Yeah. I think I have the wrong mic for you. Say that again.
Oh, the thing about people saying bollocks in the UK. There was a viral tweet that I saw earlier today, which somebody asked, do people in the UK say bollocks all that much? And there was a lot of yes.
Yes, they do. But the thing is also, it's a question of whether in the US, it's a question of, are you broadcasting in safe harbor? In the UK, it's a question of, are you in watershed? It's the same thing. So there is, in other words, there is the problem is not an issue of freedom of speech. We have freedom of speech here.
Oh, you know, we have freedom of speech in India as well. You just get
lynched
afterwards.
No. It's in our constitution. It's the Bill of Rights.
It's in our constitution too. Oh, getting lynched is not in the constitution, but you do.
Let me finish. We have the First Amendment. It is very powerful. And nobody, including the Federal Communications Commission, has the ability or right to abridge that. And
nobody needs to breach that. That's what happens back home, too.
Do you want to hear the legal rulings that affect WBAI, who went to the Supreme Court?
Yes, I know that.
You're familiar with the Carlin decision. You know about it. Okay. And do you know who changed the Carlin decision to create Safe Harbor?
Mm-hmm.
What person, what radio show was that?
Yes, I remember.
Tell me.
Because you said that the last episode I was here.
Okay, very good. Yes, so I'm saying it again. It was me. Nobody else. I take all the credit, bleep. But it was Hour of the Wolf, however. And it was
a quasi-premium. The history of the Hour of the Wolf in the Brooklyn Eagle. So, yes, I kind of
Yes, you did, although you did not tell this story.
Because the article had a word limit.
No, of course. Of course. And we will get to that. However, what is called safe harbor here means that under a certain artistic, in other words, if you're reading a short story, you can use whatever language is appropriate for the art that you are doing. However, if you were just talking, like if I was saying to you, oh, that's a bunch of bull bleep, that would not be permitted. However, if a character in your short story said, I think that's a lot of bull, that is permitted if and only if we have given a disclaimer at the beginning. The disclaimer, which is if you're listening to this program, be aware that it contains frank language. If you're offended by frank language, tune out and rejoin us at 3 a.m. when Lister, he's likely be using frank language as well. But at any rate.
So while those things exist in your constitution and so on, coming from India, and I did, like, most of my life's work has been working on freedom of speech. I worked on it. Haven't really.
But we haven't gotten there yet. So the point is, I haven't introduced the show yet, Amy.
Cool.
You know? I get to say hi to my listeners who didn't hear me last week. I'm not going to be on next week. Because we're in a fundraising drive, and so there are certain protocols that I must follow.
What?
Yeah. So let me follow them.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. So, miss me? Okay. The way Linda Perry, our program director, is handling this current thon is a way of which I approve, which is instead of just automatically preempting most programming, particularly arts programs, we are alternating within recorded programs that are guaranteed to make a certain amount of money and our regular programming so that, you know, we get to keep our audience. And we also get to ask that audience, as I just did, to support the radio station by becoming BAI buddies, which means, as I said earlier, giving something like $10 a month. And if you do that, by the way, we will have a gift for you. I'm not saying what it is because it's not officially registered, but suffice to say that this gift has been approved by our station manager and program director, and I'm very pleased with it. And it involves our guest this morning.
Oh my God, what do I have to do?
You have to autograph something, that's all.
Why? Autograph what?
Yet to be determined.
Okay. What if I didn't make it?
It's yours. I promise you.
Okay.
I have friends in high places.
I don't really have books.
It's not a book. We'll discuss it off the air.
Okay.
It might be a printout of something that you've written that you would customize an autograph to. Michael Swanwick does this all the time, so do a lot of writers.
Oh, I have one of those business cards which have a little autography section at the back where you can, like, it has a little writing section at the back.
Exactly.
So I can also, like, write an autograph there because I don't have a print book.
Exactly. So, you know, it's something like that that we'll be giving people who give good quantity, like, you know, $15, $25 or something a month to keep listeners sponsored.
What if I give $20? Broadcast. Does it become Inception? Do I have to sign my own thing?
Yes.
Like, how does that work?
It's a month. It's a month. So it's not $25. It's a month.
Yeah, so, but still, like, if I pay, then what do I get?
I'll work something out. I'll get you something cool. I promise you.
Okay.
At least a WBAI tote bag and a shot, you know, and a baseball cap. The tote bags are actually pretty good. It's shocking. I would figure us to have something really crap, but it's not. They're really very nice. And that is something that people can get. But for now, I'm just saying that if you are one of the anointed who give us a nice amount on a monthly basis, you pledge during this show by calling 516-620-3602 or visiting give to WBAI or WBAI.org, we will thank you in a cool and special way. All right. Okay with you, Mimi?
Sure.
All righty. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is the first Tuesday of every month is when we hold the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And our next one is being guest curated by Amy Goldschlager. And as is her wont, as she's done 2 years previous and will be doing this year, it will be an evening of readings with writers from a publisher called Serial Box. Now, that's serial as in serial number or...
Serial killer.
Serial killer. Ooh, yes, exactly. Tune in next week, you know, to find out the next serial killer, things like that. And we have Eugene Myers, E.C. Myers, who's just a... fun writer, but more important than that, a fabulous, wonderful human being.
And he's from Philadelphia, as I am.
You're from Philly?
Yeah.
You know, I figured that from the accent. I should have
I known. Do not have a Philly accent. Like, I had South Philly Italian friends. Their accent is, like, totally not like mine.
Okay. How would you describe your accent?
I have the accent of an Indian who has traveled a lot, which is exactly what it is.
Okay, that's a very good answer.
Like the people who move around a lot have a different accent than people who are even third culture kids or something who live in a certain place.
Yeah.
Like it's your life experience. Your accent is really your life experience.
On my favorite show in the world, which I've talked about in the past, Safari Live, which is on YouTube right now, as a matter of fact, run by Wild Earth. You get people from all different places. One of their people, a woman named Noelle, I forget her last name, is from Maine, the U.S. She's the only American involved with this show. Most people are either Boer or Indian. Trishala Naidu is Indian. She's one of my favorites there. And they all have very interesting accents, many of which sound very Australian.
Huh.
And, well, it turned out that this one person who I assumed was... Oh, and Trishala Naidu is actually, she's of South Asian descent, but she's from Australia.
So already Indians in India have like different, like your accent is different depending on what your base language is, which like not everybody's base language. I mean, India has way more people than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So
very many more, yes.
Yeah, depending on what your vernacular is, like back where we're in India... we can listen to a person's English and sometimes we can tell what their mother language is, right? So,
but it's especially interesting with naturalists and scientists because so many of them are world travelers.
Yeah, yeah, your accent does really change. Like when I first came in
here. Where you schooled matters a great deal.
No, I was schooled in India. But the thing is, especially when I went to college and I was an English major... the aspirational culture that, like, especially the English literature circle in India looks at is British, right? So there was a little bit of, like, nobody really told you to, but the emulation was British. And then I went to, like, the UK was my first foreign country. So then I first came into America. Americans think that I sound like an Indian British person. But the British don't think that because they know the Indian British people. I don't actually sound like Indian British people.
Now, to me, you sound like an Indian American.
And that might have been because I've stayed here for 5 years.
And I would think that there would also be a difference between an Indian American from New York versus an Indian American from Chicago.
Sure.
These things are very subtle. The only thing that I can really tell the difference on is the person traveled or not. That's about all that I can really make heads or tails of.
Like, I still write with British spelling, and then my editors change it.
Actually,
American editors just change all of them, and I'm just like, do you really care about my U? Why can't my U be there?
Yes, and absolutely. And I don't spell color as Clower, but I do
spell... It's not Clower.
I know, but I do spell theater with an R-E, not an E-R.
Somebody told me, like, an American told me that there are, like, different usages between, like, T-R-E and T-E-R.
Not
like,
really.
Apparently, if it's, like, the proscenium, it's T-E-R or something.
Not true. Absolutely not true. It's simply a question of preference. I think T-R-E is classier than E-R.
But you guys can't spell aluminium.
Yeah, neither can we say aluminum.
And that is not what it is.
Except for the fact that it's a creation out of Pittsburgh.
Really?
Yes.
But back then, those
U.S.
people...
U.S. Steel.
Sure, but those people used to use British spelling. That was before the Tea Party, right?
Yeah, well, this is after the Tea Party, and aluminum was invented and created. So far as I know, I'm sure somebody's right now writing me a scathing letter to tell me how wrong I am.
Okay, fine, you guys can have
but
it. But the thing is that I don't really...
But it's all from Pittsburgh.
I don't really have a stake in the British versus American, you know...
I don't either.
We are colonized subjects. We give one of those blips about the British.
When did the English first colonize India?
So the English colonization of India...
Also under George III, right?
I forget the English king because... See, originally it was not a kingly colonization. It was a corporate colonization.
Right.
The East India Company. So that is the 18th century? They slowly came in and they, like, you know, started a factory. They bought a little land. And so initially it was not really occupation, but, like, almost a century later,
But it was the East India
Company.
Tea company. Yeah, not just tea.
No. They were not bringing tea to India. They were bringing mostly shit that nobody wanted. Look, India
That, by the way, is one of the seven words.
India had... a pretty evolved civilization. Like, these people largely came in and said, we want to sell you these things. And the Indians actually want them.
So they put local
rulers. Like, you're kind of savages.
They put local rulers.
No, so what happened is, like, yeah, so this company comes in. And so the funny thing, largely in the Indian subcontinent, is that people saw these people as harmless because they were so inept. They were like, you know, these foreign merchants come in, their stuff is largely not very interesting, but okay, let us be nice to them, right? And so they start buying land and so on, and then they start investing in, like, local rulers fighting against each other. And slowly they start, like, occupying land. And almost a century later, the British crown is like, why does this company have so much land? Like, let us take it for our government.
Yeah.
And so the British Empire starts almost a century later, right?
Right.
I'm totally making this dumber for an audience. But, yeah, so, I mean... When you say, like, it's kind of vague, the date of British colonization, because the British colonization kind of starts with the company, but it seeps in, it trickles down. So you don't know exactly where it starts.
Yeah, well, we...
18th century, let's say.
This continent had the same company doing a similar kind of things
no,
with
the
furs
difference
and all
was that.
But here they were competing with other countries, and they came in here late.
Other European countries. The difference between North America and South Asia was that South Asia was a huge melting pot. It was partly on the Silk Road. So South Asia was a very diverse community already.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say, the thing that happened in North America with, like, the plagues, right? The illnesses that were brought in.
Right.
Which killed a large number of the Native American population.
And vice versa.
Yeah,
people
which
forget
kind of
that.
Meant that there hadn't been that many travelers for many centuries.
Yeah. It's absolutely true what you say. What a lot of people forget is a lot of the colonists died of local diseases as well. It was never a one-way thing.
The thing is that there wasn't that much communication between at least these populations for a long time.
There was some. It's very interesting. Two books that I've read within the last month, as a matter of fact, because I love this stuff, and I've been doing it forsaking keeping up with the current science fiction and fantasy that I ought to be reading. But I was reading first a book by, oh, damn it, what's the name of the guy who does pretty much my favorite radio show in the world? He's on the BBC. He's been there for 30-plus years. And the broadcast he does that I like the most is called In Our Time. And he's done a great many shows on the Beeb. And it's also available as a podcast. I recommend anybody and everybody to add In Our Time to your podcast list. And he wrote what he called a biography of the English language. And that shows wherever English culture and English language met a certain place, how it insinuated itself and what it took when it got to that place. It's one of the few languages to say, okay, we will infiltrate and we will take as well. The other book that I read is by an American writer who's very Anglophile, Bill Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N. He's a brilliant writer. He's wonderful. And he specialized in a similar concept, but only about American languages and the diaspora of other things coming in to the U.S. So, which goes to what we were talking about with how did things end up being spelt from R-E, which is the original and proper spelling, to E-R, and how did the U get dropped, and which, by the way, came first. There may be an argument to be made that color was always C-O-L-O-R and that the Brits added the U later.
No, it's not true.
That may be because I found other errors in Mr. Bryson's writing.
It's not a matter of error. The thing is, the English language, the Queen's English, was standardized by Samuel Johnson, 17th century.
Yeah,
right?
Too.
Like that dictionary.
Yeah, he and Mr. Pepys, yeah.
Sure. So the thing is...
But Samuel Johnson is the first,
A lot of the OU diphthongs come from French loans.
Come from...
French loan words.
Ah,
because,
yes.
Norman. So the first French wave is like the Norman invasion, which is 1066 AD, a long time ago. But then there were later French loan words because France was seen as... like this is from the Shakespearean period and later, because France was seen as an aspirable culture.
Right.
So the OU diphthong is pretty much always from France.
Interesting. Very interesting. And of course, in those days, it was the lingua franca, which is to say, if you were to talk to people from different countries, different cultures, it was the franca, it was the French language that everybody used. But then it became the English language because the French language wasn't that adaptable, which the English language, nobody really claimed to be the one.
I still
and
think
only.
That's because the English were the colonizers. Like, this is this, like, one country on an island at the end of the continent. Why would anybody learn their language?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Latin was the language for so many years, and
they were never,
and outside of the Inquisition and the church, they were never the colonizers. So it's not just that. It's a question of adaptability of the language, and French is not as adaptable as English.
It's also a question of infrastructure.
Yes.
So, for instance, like in India,
infrastructure and political pull.
Sanskrit is a very old language, and however, Sanskrit literacy used to be very limited because India had this caste system where, like, you know, Sanskrit used to be a little like Latin. So it was a liturgical language and it was the administrative language, and people below a certain caste were forbidden to learn it. So in ancient times, while literacy existed as a thing, like it had been invented in India, most of the people were illiterate, right? So the public, largely 80% of the public is illiterate, although literacy exists. So if you look at that, those historic, prehistoric societies, you largely see illiteracy behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Although historically literacy exists, right?
Right.
So a language like Latin, if you like, you know, or any language in any period, if you forbid, if you restrict the learning of it, then the contemporary population still exhibits illiteracy behavior.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And so what the
makes
British
a lot of
did,
sense.
What
yes.
the British did, especially in India, because the British didn't really invade India with an army. Right. What they did is that they became the lords.
It was an infiltration.
The infiltration, and they used local administrative structures below themselves. Like they used local public servants and so on to run their empire.
Well, this is what right. initially happened in
right.
the U.S.
So what they did is that they set up schools.
In America, I should
like,
say.
They set yeah. up schools to teach people English. They set up schools to teach people basic English, basic communication and so on. So mm-hmm. they made it possible. They made it possible and they made it aspirable to learn their language, which is the opposite of what, you know, people in the Latin diaspora had done many centuries before that.
Right.
So it's not always that the language is like structurally unadaptable. It's also what you do with it.
Right. But, you know, speaking of, I'm going to have to turn around and get to the computer to look up his name. The host of In Our Time, he's one of the most famous BBC presenters of all time. He's been on for 30 years easily. He talks about the language simply from the viewpoint of how languages evolve and adapt, and how close English came from being obliterated by the Romans, by these people, because England, for a while, was constantly being invaded by people who did not care about or for the English language.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow the language survived. And then it became something that spread and had its own diaspora 1,000 years later. It's a fascinating story.
Okay, my friend Sam Schreiber says that the name of this person is Melvin Bragg.
Thank you. B-R-A-G-G. Melvin,
yep.
It's with a Y, right?
M-E-L-V-Y-N-N.
Yes, okay.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam. That is the person I was thinking of. I love Melvin Bragg's affinity with radio. He writes good books, but his career with television and radio as a presenter and as a documentarian. He is rather brilliant. And Bill Bryson, who's also very much an Anglophile, spent a lot of time in England, has an interesting perspective. But I have discovered flaws occasionally in Mr. Bryson's writing, although he's so readable. Very entertaining as you read him. But Melvin Bragg is the show I mentioned in our time, the podcast, if you prefer, is he will choose a subject like, let's say, Charlemagne. 1 hour Charlemagne. Go. Bang. And he'll have four dons, you know, from various from Oxcam, is that how we refer to it? From Cambridge or Oxford or something?
You say Oxbridge.
Oxbridge, that's it. Oxbridge, thank you. I'm a high school dropout. What do I know?
Like, you were such an immensely aspirable thing in my college.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I have friends who went to either, like both of those. And
weren't you at one of those for a while?
I was not.
I get confused about that.
No, the subject that I studied in the UK, but like, you know, not everybody in the UK is Oxbridge.
Okay, well, where in the UK did you study?
I was in Scotland. I was in, which doesn't really even want to be UK. No, I was in Stirling.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Okay, two major things happened in history. One of them is Braveheart in the 14th century, I think 13th or 14th century. That was Stirling, the Battle of Stirling Bridge.
Yes.
And the second thing is the Stirling Library blaze, which a lot of people who, if you recognize Creepypasta, Slenderman, I mean, that is where the Slenderman made an appearance.
And there was a third.
So, you know, that is a completely uncreepy place.
And there is a third event, which we don't even know what it will do, called Brexit. But
it didn't happen with Stirling. It happened with Scotland.
Scotland is not happy about Brexit.
Those are the two things that, you know, Stirling is known for. And so, okay, so the year that I was there was the first Scotland referendum year. And we were eligible to vote because Commonwealth citizens, and this is a thing that I found out only there.
Wow.
If you're a Commonwealth citizen, but you're in the UK, so a Commonwealth citizen currently residing in the UK can vote in a UK election.
Cool. And, very cool.
And Scotland eventually did not vote. Like, right? I mean, a lot of people wanted to separate from the UK, but it eventually they like the Remain won out.
No, the Scottish vote was very anti.
Right. The thing is, and it partly won out because Scotland didn't want to get out of the EU, and now they're out of the EU, and I'm like,
against their will.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's get back to introducing the show. Good morning, everybody.
Did you already do that?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't done it. I did say this is Hour of the Wolf. I did say my name is Jim Freund. I did say my guest is Mimi Mondel. I started saying that the first Tuesday of next month will be the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Our guest curator is Amy Goldsmith, the Goldschlager. Jesus, sorry, Amy. And among the readers, I have three names, one of which is Eugene C. Myers, E.C. Myers, and more to be announced. The editor at Serial Box, Marco Palmieri, will be getting back to me. I'm screwing up names. So it's too early in the morning for me to be, too late in the morning for me to be, it's the morning. I shouldn't be doing that. Not to friends like Marco, at any rate.
Marco is probably fast asleep like a normal person.
Yeah, but he listens to this show when he wakes up.
I mean, I don't know why.
At any rate. And we also need to be telling people, if you would like to watch Mimi while we are doing these proceedings, you can go to Facebook Live and go to either the Hour of the Wolf page on Facebook or to my timeline, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. And eventually, I guess, to Mimi Mondel's site, although we will have to post it there. We only have it on a different site of her Facebook pseudonym. So, but you can watch it live or recorded at any rate, and we'll be pleased if you do so. Although I really recommend pay more attention to the radio because they're not properly synced. If we play music, you don't hear it on Facebook. It may not even be legal to play it on Facebook and all that good stuff. What is happening here at WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And we must remind you that the pledge number to donate to WBAI is area code 516-620-3602, or aim your browser at WBAI.org and click on where it says make a donation. And there, please follow the instructions for how to become a BAI buddy. That's basically it. There are other more controversial things going on, including a vote on the bylaws of Pacifica Radio, which we are part of, and I'm not going to discuss that on this show because I have a very strong opinion about that. And if I express that opinion, then people who have a different opinion are allowed equal time. And to them, I say, so, I will say this.
I wish I could do that.
You can't do a Bronx cheer?
No, I have to say one of these words.
Oh, no, it's got nothing to do with those words. This is a yes or a no thing. And one answer is from the good guys and the other answer is from the bad guys. And I will say this. Use the answer that is from the good guys. Ha! Try to get equal time based on that statement, folks. Okay. Our guest this morning has been here. What is this, your third time?
It's my third time.
It's your third time. And is always a delight to have on the program. The last time you were here was really as a scholar.
That was the first time.
Oh, that was the first time. Are you sure about that?
Yeah, the second time I had nothing to say. You just had me here.
Right, because you never have anything to say. He said sarcastically.
No, I have like unqualified opinions on a lot of things.
Yeah, you match me on that, yeah. And at any rate, this is your third time here, and it's always a delight. And thanks for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
But in between the last time you were here and this time, you did me a huge favor. You wrote a profile of me. Last time you were here, you had the photographer.
Yes, that was very embarrassing.
Paul, why was that embarrassing? Yeah, it was embarrassing because
I was reporting on the show. I was not supposed to be on it.
He didn't take any pictures of you and he didn't discuss you. The article hardly discusses you. You wrote the article.
Sure.
So nothing done. And then he came to my house where you weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And he took more pictures of me. And it was a lovely article. It was a very good profile. It was in the Brooklyn Eagle, which tickles me no small amount, because the Brooklyn Eagle is one of the great publications in the history of the U.S. You go back to the Civil War, the Brooklyn Eagle was there. Walt Whitman was one of its writers. It has a fabulous reputation. And Mimi wrote this really flattering, mostly flattering, but not even flattering, just a straightforward profile, which I was very pleased to have received.
Like, yeah, I mean, you're not supposed to write flattering profiles.
No, you're not. You're supposed to write
a
profile.
Unless you're paid.
No, but that doesn't mean I can't be flattered.
Sure.
You know, it's like, I don't care what you say about me, just spell my name right, is the old joke about that. But I was very, very pleased with what the article had to say. I was, in fact, very surprised because you only asked me certain questions and yet you elaborated so well.
I'm smart.
Yeah, that's evident, Ms. Mandel. At any rate, that article was published, what, in August or July? It was over the summer.
Sometime in the summer.
It was over the summer. And then in October, the fecal matter hit the rotating blades here at WBAI, and we went off the air on October 7th, fortunately. We came back on the air at November 7th. And curiously, outside of a collective of people that were instrumental in getting us back on the air, I was the first person back on the air. I was the program that welcomed WBAI back to the airwaves. And I went on till 5 a.m. It was quite a show. And the Eagle had a very, very good reporter, news reporter, hard news, covering what was going on at City Hall and what was going on with WBAI. But because the only photographs that they had were the ones done by this photographer who came to cover Mimi's article about me, all of the photographs, with the exception of one of the on-the-air light and things like that, in the old studio, not in the studio. By the way, how do you like the new studio?
Oh, I love it. I've seen it before, but I haven't seen it in action. I've seen it.
Yeah, but it's different microphones. It's got a different sound. It's a very different environment. At any rate, so many of the articles that were about the shutdown of BAI were not only photographs of me that were taken during the session where you were reporting about me, doing a profile, but also I was one of the primary people that was quoted in the five articles that were written. And that was all thanks to you.
Wow.
But even without that, I got a lot of mileage. Nothing that lasted, but a lot of notice. A lot of people took notice and went, wow, Hour of the Wolf.
Look, I told you that was going to happen. You didn't listen to me.
I did. Excuse me. I did listen to you. I had a good idea. I have been reading the Brooklyn Eagle for a great many years longer, I'll venture to say, than you have heard of it.
Sure.
Okay, because I was reading the Brooklyn Eagle as a kid from Queens. So I know from the Brooklyn Eagle. I really do. I really did. And I have an idea of how media works. I work in it. I study it. I'm a part of it. So
I have less of an idea of news media. I mean, I've done like very young cub journalism, and I've done like writing a column, but I've not actually been like a feature writing journalist very much.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I have not been a participant in it except as a subject, and I have been a subject before, but not as well covered.
Like that is,
and not as focused.
Yeah, that is the only article I did for Brooklyn Eagle, and they probably wanted me to do more. It's just that I realized you need to like leave the house to do journalism, and I don't leave the house.
Yeah, well, there's that. But since then, you have left the house.
I leave the house to, like, you know, do events, which is terrible.
Not just to do events.
It's just like this strange
thing. This was a leading question. I have something very specific in mind.
I was nearly going to say a bipolar thing, but I don't say ableist things anymore.
Oh, well, not a bipolar thing, but...
I either don't leave the house or I leave the house for a public appearance.
Yeah, but you did...
I buy groceries sometimes. It's terrible.
You went around the freaking world, Mimi.
Yeah.
That's what I was leading to.
Like, I know.
It wasn't bipolar because you weren't in the North Pole and you weren't in Antarctica.
Right. No, you
did a lot of traveling.
I go to two places, JFK and Trader Joe's.
Right. What were the countries you went to? Well, I was following you somewhat on Facebook. But not all of our listeners were. Where were some of the places you went?
So I don't remember when I last came in here.
It was in July. June or July.
Right. So, and these were all actually first visits because, like, you know, you need to hit a point as a in your right early career to start getting invited to things.
Any country I go to will be a first visit. I was in England once. I was in Canada once. And when I was 11, I was in Mexico.
That's I've not been to Canada or Mexico.
Okay.
So, and my cousins in Canada are not happy, but it's very cold. I'm sorry. However, so yeah, so these were all my, like, last year probably was like my first year when I made the cut to be the person who gets invited to things. And I have no money, so I don't actually travel for pleasure. I went to France in November 2018. to participate in this like futurism network. So it's a network of like scholars and activists and like artists of different kinds. So there are science fiction writers, but there are also
We should mention first and foremost that you write largely dark fantasy, but also science fiction.
I have been moving towards writing science fiction because I have a humanities background, literature, history, and so on. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was writing largely somewhat political fantasy. And so I started writing science fiction because people asked me to write science fiction. Like, this is almost a huge privilege that, like, you actually get commissioned by people to write something,
mm-hmm.
right? And some of these networks are responsible for that. Like when I went to, like I was telling you about when I went to Paris, it's a community of futurists, right? People who largely talk about the future. And they invited me as a science fiction writer. My first thing was like, look, I mostly write about history. I don't actually write that much about the future, right? And I am also not from a STEM background. It's hard for me to... It's not hard, but, you know, maybe my scientific imaginations are not accurate, right? And which is, I feel like it's a thing that gets ingrained in humanities students a lot. Mm-hmm. And especially it gets ingrained in women a lot that you can't do science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I used to be, back in high school, I was decent at science or math. It just totally got conditioned out of me. Like, once I moved on to become like an English major.
Those are my worst subjects. My only English was about my only good subject.
Right. So, I mean, English was one of my better subjects and I liked it. But once I moved on to being like an English major or something, I kind of just full on subscribed to that culture of I don't understand science. Like that popular narrative, right?
Yeah, you see, I've never gone that route. I understand popular science, and I also understand debunking.
Right.
When science is
like,
crap.
I understand the principles, and I understand when something sounds like a scam. Like, yeah. I will not be making discoveries. I am not a scientist, but I have a general idea of the principles, and I had forgotten that over many years. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was invited largely by these like European futurism networks, and one of the things they basically kept reiterating is that we are trying to be more integrative of perspectives that are not just white and Western.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we value these like people from different other communities. And I'm not just Indian. Indian is a large community in the world.
Right.
So I wouldn't, and India
to say
has a,
something is Indian is really...
And India has a lot of STEM people, so they're not only just looking for Indian STEM people, they're also looking for Indian marginalized people.
Right.
Right? And so that is one of the perspectives that they're looking for, or, you know, racially marginalized or queer, or like, you know, when they're building futures, they're talking about these futures. Like, not just these futures, but they're also asking for us to talk about what we expect, right?
Right.
What the future looks to us. And some of these places started getting me to write science fiction, which largely happened over last year. I wrote like a couple of stories.
And these were largely commissioned stories?
They are commissioned stories.
So it's not like you sat at home and said, oh, I've got to write this story, and then you submitted it to umpteen places.
No, but they still have to be submitted because these places are not always publications.
Ah.
Like they're policy type places. So
okay.
I wrote the stories. And, oh my God, my internet doesn't want to work. So I wrote...
Are you logged into our network here?
I don't think so. I think my
that may
other
be,
thing
that may
is
be
working.
Your problem.
Oh my God. Is there a Wi-Fi?
There is.
A WBAI?
Yes,
Wi-Fi?
That's a good one.
That is a WBAI 388.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is the correct one.
Do you want to put in the password?
I don't remember it. I don't want to tell the radio either, because mine is already in there.
You know, there used to be the Brooklyn Commons, but I think they've changed their Wi-Fi.
No, the Brooklyn Commons Wi-Fi is still there.
No, I am getting signal, but I'm not getting directly connected. So the last change their password.
If you, I mean, their password, I can say on the air because that's public. They've got a big sign with the password.
But on the inside,
it's composting. The WBAI password.
Somebody had to buy a coffee to get it.
No. No, that's not true. No, they have a big sign right in the place.
But
coffee
on the
or
inside.
Not. Well, yeah, they're not going to post it on the outside, and we are on the inside. We're just two floors above it. We're right.
Okay, it worked.
Okay, very good. Fine, see? That helps and also saves your battery.
It's not the battery. It took away my data. That's the notification I got where they were like, you know, your data connection has not much.
Yeah, but it also...
No, my battery is connected to
the Rick. No, the point on all phones, this is my area.
Okay, let's talk.
If on all phones, if there is a network available and your phone tries to attach to it, and can't do so.
Oh, yeah.
It keeps trying to attach and it drains your battery.
Oh, mine was not doing that.
Yes, it was. Okay. Because all phones, no matter what operating system, do that.
No, I switch off the Wi-Fi.
That's how you prevent it, yes.
And guess why I switch off the Wi-Fi? Because at every subway station it tries to connect to transit wireless each time.
Yes, that's a pain in the wireless, yeah. At any rate, my God.
We need to talk about more fun things.
We do, since the show's already more than half over.
Mm-hmm.
It is 2:04 here in New York City at WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And if you'd like to pledge, because this is something I need to do on the hour.
Could I go run and go get a glass of water?
Absolutely. It's directly over here.
Yeah.
And would you do me a favor, bring me one?
Sure.
So you can become a BAI buddy and give a regular amount of money to WBAI on a monthly basis, which provides a lot of benefits for us on the grounds that it means that we know where our money is going to be coming from in the next month. And yeah, not in the next month, over the next year. And it's something that can be factored into the budget. So the BAI Buddy is a very special thing. It's something we've only been doing a few years now. And it has become of great, great local importance to this radio station. And I promote becoming a BAI Buddy over making just an outright donation to WBAI. It means, you know, if you were to give $10 a month, over 12 months, that actually, in a way, can mean more to us than giving us $120 now. Not that I would say don't do that, but becoming a BAI buddy is a better way. And I promise you, if you become a BAI buddy during this broadcast, thank you, Ms. Mundo, then we will thank you in return in a meaningful way. Not a way that has been yet approved by some of the powers that be, because you have to go through a procedure registering stuff. But on the other hand, I was on the phone with the station manager and the program director today, who called me up especially saying, "You're on the air tonight?" Yes, I am. Neither Berthold or Linda talk like that, but I'm just, you know, it's radio talk. "You're on the air tonight?" Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I am. And what are you going to do? I'm going to ask for buddies. Oh, that's very good. Keep doing that. Thank you. So that's what we're doing. So become a BAI buddy. How would you describe your fiction in general, Mimi, if you were to just set out? First of all, what is your preferred length? Is it novellas, short stories? Do the stories dictate to you how long they want to be?
So far that I've written, which has been a while, actually. Well, it's not been a while, but I don't know. So far I've written, hit like a 6,000 to 7,000 plays, which is how my short story became a novelette.
You say that's singular.
Just that one. So there are other...
Which one?
There's this one called His Footsteps Through Darkness and Light.
Which was published by Tor.com last year. January of 2019.
And it just came out with Cereal Box. It also came out with Cereal Box.
I didn't realize.
It's the same thing.
And here I was promoting a Cereal Box reading, and I had no idea that you were affiliated with
that. So this is a very new thing that Cereal Box is doing, where they're taking out a series of short fiction. It just started maybe in November. So they bought some short fiction, largely reprints from several authors. So Seth Dickinson has one, Max Gladstone has one, Usman Malik has one, I think Indraprameet Das has one, Kelly Robson.
What a great lineup.
Yeah, there's and I have mine.
Yeah, I mean, that's great company you're in.
So it's, I mean, these are all short stories, largely
or
novelette.
You've written nonfiction, you've been a Hugo nominee, no, Hugo winner.
I know a nominee. Ursula Le Guin won that one, so yeah, no.
Oh, okay. Who won that one?
Ursula Le Guin.
Who's she? Never mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had to, because...
Right, but I don't mind it.
No, but your book, which was an anthology of essays about Estelle Butler, Junie. No, I knew her well. I didn't know her well enough to call her Junie. I only found out that her nickname was Junie the day she died.
Oh, my God.
As a matter of fact.
I mean, I have somehow...
I spent time with her 2 weeks before she died.
I have somehow ended up in her legacy a lot because, I mean, I came in to the U.S. as an Octavia Butler scholar to Clarion West. And so basically, I came in... her footsteps. Like, I could not have met this person alive because I literally came in with the scholarship that was offered because she was dead.
Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic.
Well, it's sad. But, you know, if things were better, you would have gotten in on the scholarship because she helped make that scholarship happen.
Oh.
Let's
Also, the scholarship is not in her honor. I thought it was because she passed away.
Well, that would be in her honor, you know, as it were. But
So that book, I mean, I edited it. I co-edited it. Alexandra Pierce, who is the more senior editor in those matters, is she's the one who...
One way or the other, you were a Hugo finalist for nonfiction, for actually what they call... what do they call that category?
Related work.
Right. Related work, which is actually a good name for the category. There are a lot of bad category names in both the Nebulas and the Hugos, but that's a good one. And who knows? There could be other cool stuff in the future. One can only hope. But you also wrote a story that I got involved in post production of that was for Nightmare Magazine.
Right, and it's from the same world because most of my short fiction is in the same world.
But that came into my world because I am the post-production editor.
Right.
And I got the pleasure of working on the audio of that story. I loved that story. Oh, my God. It was so poignant. It was... Now, we were talking earlier, off-air, about Carlos Hernandez. And in a way, it reminded me of not any story that he's written, but of the kind of...
Humor?
Yeah, but humor in the very British sense of the word. Humor not in the ha-ha sense.
Right, no, yeah, no.
But in the sense of the feel.
Sensibility, and, the perspective.
Yes, but humor is with a U.
Right.
Humour is really...
Don't make fun of it.
I'm trying to make a distinction to listeners because it's radio.
Okay, sure.
Because people can't... But if you say this story is in the same humor as that story, people will say, what's the gag? I don't get it. But if you say it with a U, if you use the British spelling, people are more likely to assume that what you mean is the mood and
the thing
feel.
Is that you're saying the generic people in my brain, generic people are not Americans. So if there's a certain American affectation, I just say Americans think this way.
Okay. I say people, I'm talking about my listening audience. They are American. And one Bulgarian.
One Bulgarian.
Yeah.
I can see some people from India on the Facebook.
Yeah, well, when you're on my show.
You know, two of my Indian friends.
Although from the last time you were on my show, I think a few.
Four. Oh, my God.
I think a few of the people that were listening from India when you were last on my show stayed with my show. When I do Facebook Lives, I've seen a few names from India, and I go far bleeping out.
No, this is the thing. Like, you know, like just because we're not a first world country, we don't get acknowledged. India has a big science fiction fan base.
Okay. But I have been, you know, this show started in 1971. I have been here since 1960 bleeping seven. And it's only in the last few years that our reach is farther than a 50-mile radius of New York City. So you acknowledge, please acknowledge as broadcast radio.
Like without the Facebook Live, of course, Indian readers would not be able to connect. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And for the internet feed, because we are at WBAI.org and anybody can reach that. But WBAI.org did not exist 15 years ago. And we are not yet really an international radio station. Hopefully we have people from there, hopefully. There's a new director of New York Public Radio, which we are not a part of, thank you. That includes WNYC and WQXR and all that. And that person's previous job was with Radio Marti, which was a U.S. propaganda radio station for Cuba.
Okay.
So, in other words, they are starting to recognize the international aspect of broadcasting. That's what used to be broadcasting when we were reaching at 99.5 FM to, you know, with our effective radiated power of 50,000 kilowatts. Today, in comparison with the internet, that's narrow casting.
Sure, of course.
This is something that all of us radio old-timers have to start reckoning with, and that stations like BAI have to start realizing that we are reaching out to the world.
And so one of the things that you talked about when I interviewed you for Brooklyn Eagle as well is that you said that you enjoy the thrill of, like, speaking live, speaking unscripted, and so on, right?
Yes.
And the thing is, what I notice is that thrill continues to excite people, which is kind of wild. People like things like, you know, unscripted TikTok videos and things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are people, especially younger people, doing that online even now, right? Like, that unscripted video that, you know, Facebook Live, Instagram Live,
right,
where they're just like talking at the camera, like
same
that.
Thing Instagram,
right. So the point is that joy in doing things live, doing things unscripted, doing things, you know, without being prepared to do them,
by the way, I just got a note from our Bulgarian listener saying I am indeed listening. Sorry, go on.
Nice. I'm not like not getting connectivity any.
Yeah, I've been getting problems as well, which means that our Facebook Live feed has been getting interrupted.
I thought it was probably the Brooklyn Eagles. Sorry, the Brooklyn Commons thing.
Yeah,
Wi-Fi.
I don't know which of the... I'm connected to whatever Wi-Fi is closest.
See, the thing is that a lot of public Wi-Fis, like a cafe or something, like they restrict video usage because then like a single user is taking up a lot of bandwidth.
They don't at the Commons. They don't.
So, I mean, I know that like a lot of huge public place Wi-Fis, like they won't let you make a phone call, for instance. Like they won't... They will.
Well, there are no restrictions here. Or at the Commons. I know that for a fact.
So, yeah, so are we still talking about international networks?
Well, I was interested in, because you said some weeks ago, when I invited you on the show, you were saying...
That was a year ago. Yeah.
Some weeks ago, you said I could talk. Yes, and you said something like this a year ago as well. But from these more recent trips, you had some notes about international science fiction. Simply, and when I say science fiction, we're talking so people don't think that we're just discussing, you know, spaceships and stuff like that. We're talking about fantastic literature and how it acts differently in other countries. And, it is 2:19 here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would like to read a story or a portion of a story.
I don't actually want to read.
Then don't.
Because most of my work is really online. It's super online. So
it's not the same thing as hearing an audio reading, which is why at Lightspeed Magazine and Nightmare Magazine, where I work, on the podcasts, we not only publish the stories, including the one you did last year of, I'm sorry, what's the name of the town? The place, the the printing press.
Malotibala, yeah.
That's the name of a woman.
That's actually the name of a woman.
Oh, like right, okay.
It's a female name with, the, you know, places are just called like that.
Okay. There was both. It gives you one impression reading it and a different impression hearing it. The same words in different media can be appreciated more than one way. And when it is done in the author's voice and not just in the printed word, it can either A, take on new dimensions, or B, limit and, let's say, focus the story in a manner that people can say, oh, there. See, I wasn't quite getting that focus before. When you hear it from the author's voice, it's one thing when at Lightspeed we have one of the great, you know, like Stefan Rudnick here, or Gabrielle DeCure, Paul Bamer, one of the great, great narrators, doing something, you get to hear these masterful actors voice a story, and we're very good. It's my job, actually, to write the writers and say, please give us the pronunciations. We have to make sure we get all this stuff right. And it's another thing, as we focus on in Hour of the Wolf in the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, to hear the author's voice tell the story. Which is why at science fiction conventions and at the Nebula Awards and various places, I give a seminar on reading aloud for writers.
Like if you're making me read in like 2 weeks.
No. If you don't want to read, especially at this late hour, because we are getting to the time where if you were to do that, we wouldn't have time for much else.
So, yeah, so I wanted to talk about international travels.
Why don't you talk? I've got an idea.
Uh-huh.
Instead, why don't you talk about international travels?
Sure.
Now that I forced you into it.
So I went to France. It was not really a writer's network. It was mostly people with ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are policymakers. Like, it was mostly...
Well, what was the official umbrella for the whole
thing? Umbrella, it's an organization called Plurality University Network.
Hmm.
So it's a network of academics and writers and, like, a lot of people who have opinions about the future and are somehow qualified to have them. So,
but not like politicians, per se.
Not politicians who are campaigning, but there were also people who worked...
Futurists.
Yeah, there were people who also worked for the United Nations and so on. So, like, the people who came in with, like, many different expertises. So there were scientists, right? There were people talking about climate change. There were people talking about war. So many different experts from different fields. And the science fiction writers from the America side that they had were Mia and Mary Ann Mohanraj and Malka Older. Now, Malka Older, as you know, has written like
Dr. futuristic. Malka Older.
Right, right. She's a doctor now.
She certainly is.
And she has
and mother
written
of
about,
two.
Like, yeah.
Two. Three?
I think so. I don't know.
Oh, my God. So, when she read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, she had her, I guess, just under 2-year-old.
Super cute.
Oh, my God.
And then somehow I have, like, only, I keep only meeting Malka abroad and not here. Anyway, so...
Were you here for her reading?
I don't think
so. Well, you can watch it online, but at any rate, her little girl, while she was reading, would... be on her lap, hop off the lap, run out to the beginning of the commons, and everybody's looking, keeping an eye on her, and then would run back in the middle of the reading, run back on Mama's lap. Daniel Jose Older was the other reader, so she would either go to Uncle, but more commonly to Mama, who did not,
that should have been
while
cool,
she
like...
was reading, and Malka did not break a word in stride. It was wonderful. But,
right,
she,
but
that youngster stole the show.
So, you know, I mean, a writer like Malka, who has written...
She's also a genius.
A lot about future,
the mother.
Future democracies, right? Future democracies at the intersection of...
Technology and government.
And globalism. Like, you know, corporations gone massive.
Titles
so
like
on.
Infomocracy
right.
say a lot.
Right. So and Mary Ann, who hasn't written a novel that I know of, I think she has written a novel, but it's not a science fiction
novel. I've never had
novel.
Her on the show. I would love to.
You should.
I should. I know.
And
she doesn't live here.
And yeah, she lives in Chicago.
Yeah.
And she, but she has done so much for, like, she's one of the tremendously important organizers, especially for writers of color in the community.
Right.
And she's
and
has a
founder
of Strange Horizons.
Yeah. And by the way, has been doing that far longer than people saying, hey, let's get science fiction writers of color.
And I love her short fiction.
But long before it was, shall we say, in vogue.
Right.
She has been dealing with that, with this issue, not because... it's cool, but because it's right.
And
she's been doing it 20 plus years.
Right. She's one of the first South Asian diaspora science fiction writers here. And like, that's tremendous. Like, not knowing anybody else who's doing this thing. And she's written for Wild Cards, which is
right.
the George R. R. Martin universe. So anyway, so there was me and Malka and Marianne, and I am really hoping that I'm not forgetting someone, but I think that there was the three of us. But there were science fiction writers from other parts of the world.
And who were some of the other people that were attending this event? Was it just science fiction writers?
No. This was the one that had like all these academics and United Nations people and you
right.
know other
okay.
artists. So,
how many people were there in total about?
60 people or something.
Wow.
And we were all meeting for the first time. And
given that it's mostly futurists, not enough science fiction writers.
You'd be surprised because, you know, there are a lot of people who are doing groundwork work. Like, we were writing stories. Anyway, so that was my France thing. And last year, I got invited to International Literature Festival Berlin. which is a literature festival. It was not a futurist thing, right. But they did.
It's a major, major world literary festival, yes.
And they did a small science fiction track.
Mm-hmm.
And so, once again, there was Malka and me and Karen Lord from this hemisphere.
Oh, God. One of my favorite people in the world, Karen Lord. And by the way,
she was amazing.
A genius novelist. Everybody, don't listen to this show. Stop what you're doing now and pick up a novel by Karen Lord and read it.
She had a book last year called Unraveling, which you should
God,
try reading.
Oh, God, yes. No, she, her first book was published by Gavin Grant and
Small Beer Press.
And when she came, this was when WBAI was at was on Wall Street, and you could look down from the umpteenth floor and see the lower part of New York. And this woman took a look out the window there, and she said, "Oh, I understand. During the Ice Age, as the glaciers were receding, they must have created these channels here, right? That's why you've got that island. What is that, Governor's Island?" I said, "Yes." She said, "That's why you have these two different things, the Hudson River and I guess the East River." I said, "Yeah, it used to be called the North River." She said, "Yeah, that would make sense, given the layout." And she said, "And there, when you take a look, as the glacier recedes at the very, very end of Long Island there," I said, "That part's Brooklyn." She said, "It's Long Island," which is correct. Where we are right now is part of Long Island. We're in Brooklyn. She said, "It just sort of left a wisp up like you would on a meringue pie," which is why it goes above water. "And we call that Bay Ridge." And it's like, this woman knew that by just standing at a window and looking out at the southern tip of New York, and she understood.
A lot of us non-Americans are very rigorous.
She understood how we were formed by the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And her, and this is like, no pun intended, the tip of the iceberg of this woman's knowledge about culture, about people, about stuff. All I can say is Karen Lord is one of my favorite writers.
So yeah, so Karen was there, and Karen, I haven't met her at American Cons very much. She came out of Barbados, and she had a connecting flight from New York or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were the three of us. There was Eileen Miles from New York, and who's a poet and novelist, and mm-hmm. not a science fiction person.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I had never met her in New York. Like, these, I'm just like meeting all these people in Paris.
Right.
Sorry, in Berlin. And so there were some Indian authors as well who I also didn't know. They're not science fiction authors,
mm-hmm.
but they like brought them in from India. It was very international. There was Ocean Vuong, who is a poet and literary fiction writer, just wrote a novel, Vietnamese guy.
Was any of this recorded?
They are putting up some records right now on their Instagram, but they also have a website. They did an interview with like all of us, at least the science fiction track people.
Yeah.
They did interviews with all of us. And
I would love to
online.
Find out from those people if they would like to have that broadcast.
And then in association, because a lot of these things happen if people see your name, right?
Right.
In association, I got an interview done with Deutsche Welle.
Hmm.
Which is like the radio station, but this was the this was on their website.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty cool. So that's what I did in Germany, and I looked at a lot of Holocaust memorials. Like that's what I took 3 days in Berlin, and I looked at a lot of Holocaust memorials and a lot of Cold War memorials, and I was miserable.
There are Cold War memorials.
Well, not memorials, but like you know. Historic sites.
Yeah.
Right. So the Berlin Wall.
No. Well, yes.
So the point is.
Was there anything for Checkpoint Charlie?
There is Checkpoint Charlie. Checkpoint Charlie is there.
It is still there.
Right. Nobody's doing checkpointing there.
No, well, thank
the point is
goodness.
There.
Yeah.
But the point is, after a while, somebody connected me to one of their friends who lives in Berlin, like who is a local. And they're like, do you care about the non-dead people of Berlin? Because people do fun things here, contemporarily. Like, I spend all my week looking at all the, you know, gruesome historic details. And they're like, you know, Berlin also has a great art scene. And, like, a great indie art and music and all that. And mm-hmm. I just, like, spend all my time looking at all the terrible parts of their history, which is kind of an injustice.
Yes.
But it's not a bigger injustice than the thing that was done.
You have
sure.
to remember that I'm the son of two Holocaust survivors.
Sure.
One from Frankfurt and one from Nuremberg.
And one of the things that I'm doing right now, one of the projects that I'm supposed to be writing, I will soon start. I'm writing a character who's French Romani.
Hmm.
From the 19th century. And that is very much in the discrimination period, right?
Right.
It's extremely in the discrimination period. And very little written history about that community. And if there is, a large part of the written history is in French. Like, there is Own Voices work, but those people are not writing in English. And they're still publishing largely from indie presses and so on. They're not bestsellers. So they don't really get translated, right? And I can't read French, so I am, like, now currently very quickly trying to pick up some French.
Mm.
Because, like, there is so much stereotypical G-word stereotyping throughout, you know, all of history. Especially a lot in science fiction fantasy, a lot in epic fantasy. Like, gypsy communities, quote-unquote gypsy communities, have been fictionalized so much, romanticized in very stereotypical ways that I kind of don't want to add to that.
Even when they're trying to be positive, like Romani stories and stuff like
right.
that.
Right, I mean, it's not tremendously positive if you don't acknowledge the pain. Like, it's not just people switching around in skirts, right?
Although there are exceptions. I recommend, I think it's Norman Spinrad, and I think the title is The Last of the Romani. It's wonderful, wonderful. Quasi science fiction story. Well, it's not quasi.
So one of
it
the
is.
French communities. This is very interesting. Maybe not to you. It may be interesting to
it's
Indians.
Interesting to me.
Indians. The community is called Manouche. Okay, and Manouche.
How would you spell that?
M a n in French. You spell it M a n o u c h e. The thing
Manouche.
Is, Manouche is the Bengali word for human. Bengali Ooh. Word for human is Manouche. And
that's fascinating.
The thing is. These traveler communities came out of the India region many, many centuries ago, but they did not come from as far east as Bengal. They came from northwest, like that is what has been, you know, from DNA tests and so on, whatever has been confirmed is that they were from northwestern India. Western, northwestern, right?
Right.
And Bengal is super to the east. But it's, like, so similar, like, this is probably not actually an etymological, like, it's not the same root. It's two similar words sounding nearly together by coincidence, I guess. But that is so interesting.
It is.
And do you know who the most famous person probably who came out of that community actually nearly the Holocaust period? Like, he lived through the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Did not go to a camp, but lived through the Holocaust. Jazz musician called Django Reinhardt.
Well, of course.
Sure. So.
And he was what people would call today a gypsy.
Yeah. And he came from that Manouche community, I mean, which is why the gypsy jazz, right? Isn't that what it's called?
Not so much. Actually, the hot club jazz.
Right.
Of France,
the hot club jazz.
Really what he and Stefan Grappelli did, which lives on. There are bands today that emulate that. Pearl Django is my favorite. They're actually an American Northwest band. It's become a genre, a musical genre unto itself. Great traveling music, by the way, when you're, like, if you're driving to a convention for 4 or 5 hours.
I'm never driving to a convention, but I play music at home.
Well, we drive when we go. And putting on Django Reinhardt and the contemporary followers is well worthwhile. And I occasionally play a little Django on this show. A little Django jingle.
But not right now.
No, not right now, although the temptation is there. But we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time this morning. Yeah.
So that is totally not the same period as him, right? That story that I'm trying to write is almost a century before him.
Yeah. And also an interesting thing about Paris of that era is it was one of the few places where different people of expatriates of the U.S. and other places could go, like Josephine Baker.
The left bank culture kind of started.
Exactly.
But a large part of the left bank culture was also what in American current language you would say gentrification and appropriation of these traveler people's cultures, because they were literally, they were pretty much living in places that would be like ghettos, right? And a lot of these, like, you know, bohemian artists, again, bohemian is a word that was often used for that community, right?
Even though bohemian itself means
a different thing altogether.
Bohemia is a different, totally different country,
So a lot of these artists were moving into these, like, poor people's neighborhoods, you know, and trying to live like the poor people because, you know, that was the cool way to live.
And because they liked La Boheme.
Sure. No, that is slightly later in the century because I was actually working on that. I was working on the development of the Can-Can dance. And so one of the people I really want to use as a character, I don't know if it'll be sustainable, is Baudelaire.
Ooh. That's now there's an idea.
So
that's a fabulous idea.
Once again, he's like somewhere nearly around that period. I think he was born in the 1840s or something.
Mm-hmm.
So almost went to India. He almost went to India. Then his ship got shipwrecked or some stuff, and he ended up in the Mauritius, I think. He was in the Mauritius Islands. He didn't like hit the mainland of India.
Right.
But then there were also some like Indian people largely working as working class people there, and he had like an affair kind of thing with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a poem, okay? There's a poem called To the Malabar Woman. And then he apparently came back and he was like in his early 20s. Like, you know, this is another of these funny things. Like, if you read the articles written about people from 2 centuries ago,
mm-hmm.
like where they speak of them as like this venerable gentleman, turns out the dude was 18. So, yeah, I mean, he was
yes,
like a
I have discovered that about a whole lot of people. There was this week's episode of Doctor Who. Featured, was placed in where so many people like to put things, in the cottage in Lake Geneva, where Mary Godwin, who was calling herself Mary Shelley at the time, but she was Mary Godwin, and
she was also early 18.
17.
Right.
She was 17. And with child. And she was with Percy Bysshe Shelley and all that. And John Polidori, who wrote Vampire, the first major.
Sure.
He's depicted as this guy who's like 22, 23 years old. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is a much older guy. And I looked it up. No, he was dead by the time he was 27.
Right.
Yeah, I had no idea. I thought he was like so much older.
Concept of childhood and youth were like so different back then. You know, and people say, like early Baudelaire, he was like such a wasted dude, and then you like, you know, you add up his age and he's like 18. He's an 18-year-old, you know, college student doing drugs, which they still do. You know, I mean, what are we talking about? What are we like, you know, why are we calling him an irresponsible person who squandered away his parents' wealth? I mean, all the rich kids do that at 18.
Well, so yeah, it's part of the
But he also
part of the job definition of being an 18-year-old.
So
yeah.
I think his like stepfather or somebody sent him to India to gain character, and that is how white people gained character back then, you know. And he ended up in Mauritius, and he had like this affair with an Indian woman. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back, and he finds Jean Duval, of course, who was Creole. So I mean, he clearly liked brown women, I guess. So yeah, I mean, I want to see if I can use him in some manner. I mean, Angela Carter has written really well about
him. Yes,
that, so, I mean,
yes.
Uncomparable.
Now, the thing that fascinates me the most about this is that, in theory, if one takes the ideal of science fiction, the kind of stuff that academics like Darko Suvin and Joanna Russ and Samuel R. Delaney, for that matter, would talk about, science fiction is supposed to be, what's the word? Not post-national, but above.
Post-human.
Yeah, in a way. You know, in other words, it's supposed to be looking at a bigger, better picture, even though in reality, when we look at a lot of science fiction and we look at the creeps that are trying to drive what the science fiction movies and literature are, I'm talking about puppies, for those people who know what I'm talking about, and if not, don't worry about it. We're supposed to be taking a much bigger view down at all literature, all culture, and folks like that. And all of a sudden, we get exposed to what? You mean to say that Asian people write science fiction? Are you telling me that, Ken Liu? Are you telling me, Mimi Mondel, that there are, that Mr. Ray was trying to make science fiction films and stuff like that? And the answer is, yeah. And it's somehow never quite the science, you know, the organization that was the organization for science fiction was the science fiction, not science fiction fantasy, not fabulous fiction, not speculative fiction, the science fiction writers of America. And, of course, we now understand this, and certainly, like today's president of SFWA, Mary Robinette Kowal, does not subscribe to that. It does help to be English-speaking, that is true, but it's not about just science fiction or fantasy or, you know, they don't want to change the name, and I don't change the name of, when I say Hour of the Wolf is about science fiction.
Oh, that just reminds me.
That could be Lord of the Rings.
I am, oh my God.
Yes?
I had an announcement. So I am working on an anthology of science fiction and fantasy from South Asia. So South Asian science fiction fantasy coming out of India.
In English?
In English.
Okay.
Yes, I actually limited that. I mean, there are people,
you are multilingual after all,
in other languages, but fewer. Like, most Indian science fiction writers are writing in English. And I just thought it was a different process of acquisition. So, like, you know, when you're doing an anthology with a publishing house, you also have a resource limit, right? So if you're acquiring translations, and given that India doesn't just have one language, you have to give like a little importance to each language which you don't speak, right? How many people speak many languages? I speak two languages, right? But three, like English and two Indian languages. But
I speak American English in Brooklyn.
So the thing is, if I'm taking translations, now Bengali, my language, is one of the majoritarian languages of India.
Which is?
Bengali.
Oh, Bengali.
Bengali is
okay,
a huge community.
Yes.
So the thing is, then there are other,
I know you're from Kolkata, but
right, the other languages might also not feel represented. But on the other hand, like, I am an external editor working with a publisher, mm-hmm. and I'm probably, I don't have a slush reader. I will be given a copy editor at some point. I am not always equipped to deal with translations from other languages. So it's like, you know, publishing is a lot about
other factors like resources.
Yes.
Right? So for this anthology, and I know that since I am the anthologist, I am the one who gets to write an introduction, right? And when your scope is limited, then one of the honest things to say is that my scope is limited in your introduction. Mm-hmm. Like I can say, instead of saying that everybody in India writes in English, I can say that this is what my resources let me do. So it's an anthology of writers in English. While there, and also it's a South Asian anthology.
So there is more than this book has focus for.
Right. And it's also a South Asian anthology, so it's not just Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another very tremendously important thing to remember, given that we're the big country in South Asia.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, don't forget that, you know, those other countries exist as well.
Yes.
So it's a South Asian anthology, which makes it harder because eventually I'm taking 20 authors. Right. So it's not everybody. It isn't everybody. Eventually it is.
How are you soliciting?
20 stories that I liked. And that is another thing that will go in my introduction. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That within this scope, these were 20 stories that I have liked in the past. So they're largely reprints.
Okay.
You're
not commissioning anything?
Some of them are originals. Very few. The thing is, it's also a matter of payment because our currency is so much cheaper. And these people are writing in English, so it's the first English rate.
Ooh,
right?
Okay.
Which means a lot of writers are probably not willing to give this thing an original instead of an American magazine if they can sell it there.
Right.
Right? So these are all the logistics. What I wanted to, the point that I leaped off.
Does
from
this
your
have
point,
a publisher?
Yes, yes. So the publisher is called Aleph Book Company, and mm-hmm. they are based in Delhi. The anthology is called Old Earth, New Skies.
Ooh.
So that is the name.
I like that.
And then you give it a subtitle.
That's
right?
Actually a very classic science fictional sounding title.
I love it. See, I am a genius.
There, yes.
But we
knew that when we invited you onto the show. He said,
so this
royally.
Is an announcement. This is like the first time I'm talking about it. And so we had a subtitle and we were like, you know, it has to fit on a book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like anthology of South Asian science fiction and fantasy short stories does not fit on a book.
Right.
So eventually you go with the Aleph Book of South Asian science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not obviously all science fiction, you just say that. And like, there are also other considerations like Aleph Book of Speculative Fiction. Well, lots of people don't know what speculative fiction means, especially
right.
in a country like India where English literacy is secondary.
In the
like,
U.S.?
The book will not sell. People don't know what's in it.
Yeah. The definition of speculative fiction is not today what it was when the term was coined.
And also, it's really like a term coined by Margaret Atwood. There are
The term was coined by Robert Anson Heinlein in 1946.
I've been told it was Atwood, but
they can tell you what they want. It was coined by Heinlein, and ironically, when he coined the term, it's a term that he invented. It's
okay.
his term.
Right, of course.
And what he meant was, ironically, pure hardcore science fiction, which the science must be rigid. Speculative fiction today has almost the opposite definition. The person who brought it back into popularity is Kelly Link.
Ah.
Okay. 10 years before Margaret Atwood ever used the phrase, Kelly Link and Gavin Grant were promoting it in Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet.
I love that magazine.
And when Kelly's writing,
Kelly has been like, you know, overwritten
so
a lot. He's
in,
so talented.
She is such, and you cannot pigeonhole what she writes. And some people have come up with terms like interstitial fiction for it. There's slipstream fiction and all that.
Interstitial is an even worse word. Like, I don't like academic jargon in the public space.
But
like,
this
if
is,
people can't spell it.
But exactly. But this is a term that Delia Sherman and others have been working with, and the stuff that they publish using that phrase is great stuff.
No, I can respect a person and not agree with everything.
Yes, but speculative fiction, became recoined and brought back into the world as a result. I don't know if it was by Kelly Link, but it was to her that people were using it because they did not know how to define the story, the girl detective, for example.
Right.
Or magic for beginners. How do you define that? You cannot. And so the term speculative fiction came back into use. And people then said, well, Margaret Atwood belongs there. Well, no, she writes science fiction. We can argue it. The reason so many people, including Kurt Vonnegut and Jonathan Lethem and so many people say they don't write science fiction is so
that they can, you know, qualify for the Booker. It's okay.
It's not just that. But yes, you're not wrong.
The Booker, the Pulitzer.
It's so that you'll get paid better by your publisher. If you put science fiction on the cover, you are not getting into the front window in bookstores, at least not 10 years ago.
Right, I get it.
You were ghettoized and all that. But if you give it a phrase like speculative fiction, something like that, I mean...
It sounds like you can say polysyllabic words.
You know, they would take Octavia Butler's books and they would not put it under science fiction. They would put it into black studies.
And that has happened with my work as well. Like, I get put into Dalit studies a lot. And, I mean, one of the reasons I get invited to some of these futurism conventions is that I have academic degrees.
Yeah.
And I know that.
So, speculative fiction became embraced by many SF writers, because you can still say I'm an SF writer.
Look, I have used it. I have used it.
Absolutely. And it has a greater air of respectability than the ghetto of science fiction. And also,
your stories are mostly not science fiction. The thing that you say, the ghetto of science fiction, is also changing, right?
It is.
So, I mean... In a few generations, or not even few generations, maybe even the next generation, because things change between one generation and another a lot. Look, I think a lot of Golden Age and so on, science fiction, like this is the blasphemous opinion, is tremendously poorly written. Like their literary quality is not that great. And I think
I would be a little more succinct in what you're trying to say. The writing sucks. I mean, look. Philip K. Dick was a genius. What he did with a lot of his writing transcended what came before it in so many ways.
He's not even somebody I dislike that much, but a lot of the pulp stuff.
That's not pulp.
No, and he's also Silver Age. He's not Golden Age.
Yes, he's...
The
60s. He's 50s and 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Valis is 70s right, and all that.
Right.
But he wasn't a good writer. His prose was never very good. He wrote in a style that was sort of crystal clear as water, but he had awkward phrasing, not... I mean, Raymond Chandler is another story altogether. And Chandler could turn a phrase, but he was a very awkward writer.
Mm-hmm.
Philip K. Dick is sort of like that as well, only he didn't have the skill until
right.
it was very...
I mean, I'm not even being as harsh as you. There... Like, Philip K. Dick, I would still read. But there are some people who are
I read a lot of these people, but they...
Like, I enjoy his stuff. Like, I wasn't
but for the most
that jarred.
For the most part... Science fiction writers are not good writers, and that's...
I think we're not, because this...
A lot
are... Expectations are changing a lot more right
now. You want
now.
1 second, because I see... Hey, Max! Huh? Any sign of the show after me? Or are you going to cue...
There are no naked men wandering around the station.
Well, then, could you cue something up?
You don't think he's...
You know, we can keep talking.
He needs to be here in three... my outro should be on the air right now.
Look, we can keep talking if he's not here.
Well, it's up to Jim.
I can talk for a while, but I also...
I'm under orders of what to put on should we have no program.
Well, then maybe you should be preparing what those...
It won't take me long.
Okay, yeah, so
sadly
if you... If you could prepare that, because I wouldn't mind sitting here with Mimi talking for another 2 hours, but I'm paying for somebody to be downstairs to drive me.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that is a limiting factor.
And I have a meeting at 1 p.m. So.
Yeah, exactly. Although I must say our conversation is moving enough to allow us to go another 2 hours easily.
Not 2 hours. I can do another half an hour.
Nah.
You don't think he's on the way?
I don't think he's... Well, you know what? I can take a look. Pardon me if this... Wait a second. Here we go. He is on the way.
Oh, okay.
So my phone is not even opening this anymore. What's going on?
Two words. Subway stuck.
Yep.
So we will stick it out until he gets here.
I beg your pardon. Why don't you do radio instead?
Because we're on Facebook Live. Oh. But at any rate. So, yes, he is coming. I don't know the time that he sent those messages. Because the moment I acknowledge those messages...
Here's someone called Todd Mason who says the same thing, exactly the same thing that I said.
Yeah, what does Todd say? He's very knowledgeable.
Yeah, when you said, the writing was, were not is a good way of saying it. When you said, science fiction...
I think there's a lot that still is not.
He says the level of prose quality has certainly been rising, getting better since the 50s generation.
That's correct.
Yep, I agree.
It really began, I would say, becoming noticeably better with Le Guin and with Joanna Russ and Theodore Sturgeon. And there's a reason why those names from the 60s are with us today. They could write well. They were good. And many of the other people of that era were still, and some are still, trying to play catch-up. And there's a great and terrible thing happening, and that is that the internet is bringing a true democratization of publishing, mm-hmm. where you have websites that are and organizations that are publishing sometimes very, very high quality stuff and really good stuff that gets better as people go from there to become professional. But a lot of people are just putting stuff up on their friends' websites, and is vanity press at its worst. You can pay to have your stuff come out as a book. No editor has ever said, I respect the writing you have done.
But I also think that one of the things that we're saying about the internet, like, and this is true of social media as well, like when you look
social
at...
Social media is
listen,
internet.
No, so what I'm saying is you look at social media and you see all these people and say that all these people have negative opinions or all these people have opposing opinions to myself. The thing is, about whatever, like the political opinion, like all these people like the president and... Oh my God, I had no idea all these people liked the president. But the point is, even before the internet that happened, it was just that you couldn't see it from your home. So vanity publishing, people publishing things like, in little zines or things, like a lot of zine writing was terrible. And not all zines were radical. Some of them were just people publishing their friends.
But a lot of
stuff.
Zine publishing is great. For Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet
is a
zine.
You're doing Not All Men here. Okay. I'm talking about a lot of crap writing by people publishing their friends and people thinking they're intellectuals. And that happened everywhere. And those people call themselves little magazines. They call themselves zines because you can't stop them. They existed. Good zines existed as well, but then there were also these people. Just because they're on the internet now and you can see them, you think they've increased, increased. They have not.
Once upon
not
a
that
time,
much,
you
least.
Had to have access at the very least to a mimeograph. The things that you're talking about that came out in little presses and things like that were at the very least bound. They were put, somebody had to spend money to put them out and had to recoup the losses, which is not true with a website or a blog.
That just made it possible for privileged people. How does it make it better?
I'm not saying it does.
Right. So
I'm
not, still...
I wasn't. I never made the argument that made it better.
So back then, there were just rich people making trash, and now there's a democratization of trash. How does that make it better?
But that's exactly what I was saying. I was saying that the fact that there is greater access is a double-edged sword, and that also means that the signal-to-noise ratio, the trash-to-quality, is perhaps worse today than it was earlier.
No, I don't think so, because I also think that legit publishing, like trade publishing, also takes out bigger numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Before, like, you know, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, I studied trade publishing. They were not taking out that many books, as many books as they do right now, though. We're just so much subsumed by, like, you know, TV or, you know, cinema, which... bigger budgets and bigger audiences,
mm-hmm.
that we think, of course, publishing is now the third biggest. But if you look at like the print run of, say, what do you call it, Charles Dickens or something, or the number of people who read Dickens in his time.
Yes.
Modern best-selling writers are actually selling more than that. Yes, if you really just look at those numbers. Right?
Todd Mason now says, well, there have always been substandard professional magazines, but webzines... which have less quality.
Yes, yes, I agree.
Widely ignored.
I agree with him again. Like, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the internet that doesn't mean that everybody's being forced
and
to look at it.
I have a different feeling about that. My feeling being that there are a lot of well-known, I'm going to stick right now to not webzines, but let's say podcasts that do original fiction.
Todd also talked about a publisher.
Hmm?
Todd also talked about a publisher, but you can just see it later.
A specific publisher?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll see.
That is the comment.
I'm not worrying. Oh. I saw something
I see the point. I see the
point. Well, I need to point out that I was the slush pile reader for Jim Bain before we go any further, Todd. So, you know, been there, done that. The place where I worked for Jim Bain was called Galaxy Magazine. And the writers that we included were Joanna Russ, and so forth. People do not realize what a great editor Jim Bain was, and that he was not just publishing
institutions
like that
exist in your name are not you.
But also, that's not a little magazine. That's not a fanzine or something like that. There are podcasts, there are some that really endeavor to do good things, like the one that comes out of Brooklyn, in fact, comes out of the Brooklyn Science Fiction Writers Group. And there are
Kaleidocast, that's the story.
I have
a story in it this year.
That's in volume 3?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't do numbers.
Has it been done yet?
It's just coming out.
It's volume 3.
Okay.
Barbara had one in volume 2. Sabbath Wine, in fact. Another another
of
production
course. Yeah,
of Sabbath
I love
Wine.
Story.
Yeah. Well, was a Nebula nominee. Well, what can we say about Nebula nominees other than...
It was a great story.
Yeah.
And
Nebula nominations, by the way, for people listening, are coming out tomorrow, or that is today if you're in New York, Thursday.
Around noon or 1 p.m.
Around noon.
That's what I know. I'm not sure.
Is when the Nebula nominations are coming out. And
the Hugo nominations are open.
Yes, they are.
Or whoever is voting.
And anybody who wants to become a member of the World Science Fiction Association for each year can vote for the Hugos. The Nebula nominations, the Nebula Awards, are limited to members of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. So one is a peer award and the other is a fan award. Both have value. But for me, getting a Nebula nomination is head and shoulders above, not head and shoulders above, but it says something that your peers are saying you are one of us, you are good. And there's a quality as opposed to you are popular. Also, the nebulas only have a limited number of categories, so they've been opening up. They now have a nebula award for games, which I don't really quite understand.
It's been, the game writing has been around for a while, though. I actually
game writing's been around. Yeah. I used to be the game critic for Computer Shopper magazine.
No.
I know
the Nebula 4 game writing has been around for a while. I looked it up.
Two years?
No.
Mm-mm.
Really?
Really? There was no such award when Barbara was nominated 2 years ago.
Huh.
No, it's new.
It may be new. I'm maybe mixing it up with something else.
Yeah. The Hugos are another story altogether.
Hugos don't have game writing.
I don't think they do yet.
They don't.
They do.
It's related work. But the
Nebulas have.
They do. I
and,
because
and,
I know people whose games from Choice of Games got nominated.
And you know, there are great people writing games. There he is. Come on in. We need to leave. I understand all the work that goes into writing games. It's great craft. Carlos Hernandez writes games.
I wanted to, but I don't know if I have, like, I self-reject.
Naomi Novik wrote games before she was writing prose science fiction, and she was writing fanfic as well on a very high-quality level. But
I wanted to write a game, and then I realized I'm not a fun person.
Oh, stop it. Also, games aren't necessarily fun.
But they have like a spontaneity element.
Some do. Some don't. The worst of them have no spontaneity whatsoever. Some of them, a lot of them, are simply, you must get this sequence of events right, or else you can't play the game. And it just dies then and there. So, And I could name those games. I won't. To me, the best games are still the old Infocom interactive text adventures. And they have better graphics, too. And most of them are available for free and playable on mobile phones nowadays because they don't require the processing power of graphic games and...
I just got a gaming PC in my effort to be a more fun person.
Oh, all right. To me, a gaming PC is paying for a good quality PC and you're just spending double.
I didn't spend double. I bought it on a Black Friday sale, which is like super capitalist. But you see,
whenever they call it a gaming PC, it's just like, oh, yeah, okay, fine. It's got a good card. It's got... memory, how much memory you got?
I forgot, but, you know, I
16 gigs?
More.
Good.
I mean, I forget the specs, but I
as long as you
specs,
have
so
as
like
long as you
do...
have a high-end video card, graphics card, and that you have to have tons of memory just for audio editing. I have 12 gigs of memory, and I'm thinking of adding
editing.
More. And my computer is 10 years old and still working great. And people might call it a gaming PC. I just simply put in the stuff for the specs. Then again, I'm a computer professional. So.
Right. So, I mean, I used to get my computers assembled back in India. I mean, I don't
That's
do it myself.
That's the best way to do it, yeah.
Because I am not, like, physically skillful at it, but I understand specs.
Yeah.
So I can tell which parts to get.
Blah. Okay, Our web stream is starting to die. Lister!
No, it's working. It's working on mine. I think it's the Wi-Fi.
Yes, but when mine goes out, all internet goes, all Facebook Live goes out. Okay? That's the difference. And Lister, it's 3:11. I've had somebody waiting for me downstairs since 2:45.
Okay.
So I need to get moving.
So are we done?
Well, we will be. He has to come in here.
So are we saying, like, goodbye?
Well, yes. Where do people find you online? And now, okay, we're saying goodbye to Facebook. I'll tell you that because it is going offline. So,
okay, bye, Facebook.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah. But, you know, the broadcast continues. And let me just do that to make sure that there we go. Very good. Okay, so the Facebook part of our program is over, although people can still, you know, ask questions and make comments. You can do that forever. But Burn Baby Burn Clappers is coming your way. So, listener, my understanding is we are preempted next week, and after that, we're back to quasi-normal. Mimi Mondal, M-O-N-D-A-L, for those who didn't hear how I said it. Do you have a home online where people...
Myname.com.
Okay, MimiMondal.com.
And I'm mostly on Twitter and Instagram at Miminality, which is like minimality, but you do it spoonerist.